everybody. Welcome to today's episode of the OIG Roundtable. We have a lot to cover. We got a lot of stuff. We're continuing our conversation on SIU operations. Again, we're getting back to some of those conversations. We're still going to be hitting those press releases in the future, but we kind of wanted to continue our conversation that we started about a week ago, where we were talking pretty in depth about some of the kinds of trials and tribulations of case management and things of that sort. We want to talk about some of the things that we've been noticing with a lot of our SIU-related work, and particularly in the greater payment integrity space. And of course, I have my two partners in crime, Matt Kachansky, the retired special agent in charge from the OIG and the retired director of the Northeast UPIC, and now our director of our payment integrity team and our SIU team. Every day, Matt seems to wear another hat as he gets brought in on more and more of these projects. And so I think for your anniversary at the end of the year here, we're going to get you another head for more of the hats that you're wearing. And of course, Wade McFall or McFowl, we're not sure what we're calling him, but it's McFowl or McFall, depending upon what part of the country you're in. We've determined that. Retired assistant special agent in charge from the LA field office and now a manager on our SIU team. And Wade has actually been getting a little bit more diverse outside of just working as a manager on our SIU team. He's really been working on some process improvement on a couple of our larger clients that we've got longer term engagements on. And Wade, I want to start with you because one of the things that we've been seeing are obviously we talk about this a lot. We talk about SIUs being like the old Life Cereal commercials, Mikey, give it to Mikey, he'll eat it, he'll eat anything. And the fact that SIUs become the dumping ground for things. And one of the things that we've noticed on a couple of our case reviews that we've been doing is that SIUs tend to have these large inventories of cases that include identity theft. And whether it's provider or member, and it may not make that much of a difference, but we're noticing that SIUs are opening up these cases that involve identity theft. And, you know, obviously we know that our ability to do these investigations are fairly limited, but we're noticing that there are a lot of these cases that are open. And you know, one of the questions that's always kind of asked is, you know, how can we flag them and what can we do and that? So let's talk a little bit about that, because it's obviously one of these things where when you've got these cases open and you're dealing and having to work these cases, there may not be an instance where you're going to get any of that money back or any of that. So if we're talking strictly about return on investment and the financial expenditures, it could cost a lot of money for Wade McFall to do a lot of nothing on a case that involves identity theft. And it may be really something that's better handled by the payment integrity team, whether it be a flag on the account to reduce that claim to prepay or something like that, right? So let's talk a little bit about that, because that's something we're noticing more and more of these cases, right? There's a ton of breaches coming in from payers, from hospital chains and providers. So we're seeing that you can buy in wholesale patient information and member information, leading to a lot of this identity theft.
Right. Well, first, I would argue that there is a big difference between an identity theft case of a provider versus a member or a Benny, just because of the exposure that, so just to kind of oversimplify it, if it's a member whose identity has been compromised, a provider can bill fraudulent claims for that one member or beneficiary. Whereas if you have a identity theft of a provider, so his provider number has been compromised, somebody is using that number where they can bill for hundreds or thousands of members for fraudulent claims, as opposed to the exposure for one member being compromised. So I think there's a, at least exposure wise and like ROI wise, there's a huge difference. We did see a lot of these cases in LA back in the day where members would, or Bennies would, their number would be compromised a number of different ways. They would take money to go to a clinic, or they would just appear on different lists. But at the time it was the ZPIC, prior to the UPIC, they had what they called the PR list, a personal responsibility, where once a member was identified as having been compromised, they were on this list and there was they were flagged in the system. Now, the mechanics of it, exactly what the ZPIC would do once they came across a claim for a flagged member, I'm not sure exactly. I think it was kind of a prepay process where they had to I think that, I don't know if they had to request records, but they were identified as members of this PR list or compromised list. So we would kind of monitor that. We didn't open cases on members or beneficiaries. We almost never did that with the OIG just because of resources. We didn't have time to spend on something like that. Instead, we would look at the providers who were compromised or somebody who was using a compromised number. But when it comes back to in the SIU world, I think where we're kind of trying to go with this was where do those leads end up? And a lot of times they end up as the dumping ground with the SIU. And I think part of the problem with that is they have to define fraud, waste, and abuse, because there's different buckets that those leads go into. It may be, depending on the issue, it may be it should go to enrollment. Perhaps it should go to program integrity, maybe just the customer service call center, but everything gets dumped into the SIU. Now the SIU has work that they shouldn't be doing, and they're spinning their wheels because they're just getting inundated with all these leads. Right. So that's the first thing, is to figure out kind of in the triage process, what is the basis of the lead and where should it go? If it shouldn't go to SIU, don't send it there just as a dumping ground. I know some of the plans we've talked to, they say that like the call centers, as soon as somebody mentions, even just a member mentions, oh, it could be fraud, or the word fraud comes up, it's right. Like, okay, stop right there. It's going to SIU. And that's not, shouldn't really be the case.
Well, and you bring up a good point, and that really winds up being a training issue, right? Because if your hotline or your call center people don't fully understand the nature of the case, which is fine, and they just refer it over to the SIU, there's going to be somebody at the SIU who's either an analyst, a triage person. There's typically someone that does that. In some smaller plans, maybe not, but in larger plans, we know that that's the case. And the thing that I think becomes the issue is we can generally bucket cases, investigations, or allegations. We can generally bucket them into a variety of categories, right? It might be misrepresentation of services, services not rendered, upcoding, right? There's a handful of probably 6 or 8 buckets. And identity theft seems to be one that's a consistent across, regardless of who the payer is. And it's one of those things where the hotline person or the initial complaint vetter may not understand where it needs to go. But at some point, there should be at some point a flow chart, whether it's a Boolean logic, right, if you know that, or something along those lines where it says, if it's this, then it's this. It's yes, no, right? That's Boolean logic. We see them in charts all the time. You start with something, yes, no. Yes, it keeps going one way. No, it goes another way. And I think that's where in the payment integrity space, things need to start going, right? Again, we talk about payment integrity in a much more global sense than we do SIU versus payment integrity. And I think, you know, we have to start thinking in those terms, because there are a lot of cases that the SIU winds up dealing with. And you look at these case inventories and you're like, why is an investigator have 50, 60 cases in some case, in some instances? And then you dive a little deeper in and you go, well, you've got 10 cases that are identity theft cases. And there's been no work on them because there's no work to do. And it's like, are you coordinating with payment integrity? Is that member's ID being flagged? Are those claims being dropped to prepay? Is it provider identity theft? Is the provider being dropped to it? And I think that's where some of this evolution has to go. Again, it right case, right time, right? The right place. Because I think, you know, where that has to go. And so, Matt, that kind of gets from the overall payment integrity workflow. And then from a leadership and management perspective, it's, you know, as you're starting to add into these things, we then see cases that involve, like, for example, policy violations where the provider, you know, there's a policy that says you can only get, you know, 2 cortisone injections in a 12-month rolling period. And you've got providers getting 3, 4, and 5 of those. And those aren't SIU cases. And in that same vein, you've got old codes, deleted codes, where payment integrity policy are not necessarily keeping up with payment methodology and the modeling. And so you've got cases where it's a policy violation where the SIU should maybe never get involved. You've got a case involving an old or a deleted code where the claim should just be rejected, but the provider gets paid. And then it's a year later and the provider says, well, I didn't know that I'm not supposed to be paid for this anymore. And that, you know, what you've really got is an exacerbated condition that just becomes made worse by the fact that a policy violation, an older deleted code, which could be considered a policy violation, doesn't even fit the metric for what would be considered an SIU case.
Right. Yeah. And you're right. It's, you know, the responsibility of the SIU, the definitions have gotten broader and broader as to what the SIUs are supposed to handle. You know, we've run across in some of our clients, the deleted codes for mattresses, old DME codes that have been outdated for years. We found billings for them still being paid. And, you know, they're asking us as their designated SIU, you know, go and collect on those. It's like, yeah, we could do that because it's data driven. There's not a lot of work at that point. But what they were not doing is putting the edits in the system to stop them in the first place. And that seems to be the simplest way to, you know, garner savings and stop these things from happening and stop putting things in the SIU's plate that should be handled by others, whether that be in, you know, claims administration or the PI upfront edits, whatever it might be. The same with the identity theft. When we were at the UPIC, you're right, they had a compromised HIN or HIC or MBI list. When we came across that came across identity theft, whether it be member or provider, we had to put those numbers on a list. The only thing we had to do was to validate through probably an attestation of the member or the provider that, yeah, they didn't provide that service or they didn't get that service and they believe their identity was threatened, was stolen. And then we sent that forward with a MAC, the administrative contractor, then flagged those numbers. You know, they didn't change them at that point because, you know, the HICNs anyway were associated with the Social Security number, so they couldn't do that, but they flagged them.
Right.
And that's what should be done.
The thing that's interesting is that, so for those that don't know, a HICN is health insurance claim number. That's also known as the old Medicare ID number, which was intrinsically connected to a Social Security number. And then there was a letter or a letter number combination at the end, which had some other designators about whether you were the primary, the secondary, dependent, disabled. There were a bunch of categories. There was really a whole list. And you had to have the list to be able to understand what that last bit would be. You know, if you were the primary person for Medicare, it would have an A at the end. If you were the spouse or the secondary, it was a B. If you were the disabled child, it was C1. There was a whole list of these things that were out there. And then when they switched over to what's known as the MBI, the Medicare Beneficiary Identifier, that number was a crosswalk to your original HICN, and it took the place of your HIC, because if you got your wallet stolen, you would have your Medicare card. Now someone had your name, they had your Social Security number, and then they had a bunch of other things. So they created this MBI for really the purpose of being able to use it like a credit card to turn it off, which really hasn't happened because they don't really do that. So, you know, they may flag the list. And at one point, the humor of it was that years ago, it was a manual list. They actually have like a spreadsheet that they were keeping of all of the identity theft. But now, because identity theft is so commonplace, it's a whole other thing. And there's obviously some questions about how is that data shared with Medicare Advantage plans? Because if you're a Medicare Advantage member, you don't have an MBI for that number. You have an MBI, and the Medicare Advantage plan actually crosswalks the MBI to an ID number for that plan. Because you have a card that says that it's part of, you know, whatever that Medicare Advantage plan is. So on the back end, there's a crosswalking of those numbers, but on the front end, you don't use your MBI to get services, you use your Medicare Advantage ID number. So it's an interesting piece of the puzzle. And I think that the take home for the three of us is in the SIU space, if people are working on cases that involve identity theft, you have to really think about to what extent are you able to work those cases, and are those really SIU functions, or are they greater payment integrity functions where it should be handled in some other shape or form, i.e. a flag to drop any claim for that to prepay and make the provider prove that that item, service, or procedure was actually rendered to that person. I mean, how often do we go to our healthcare provider and they make a show ID and they scan the ID at every visit? Like, what other things are out there? You know, whether it be a screenshot, a camera. I mean, there's a bunch of things that are out there that you can use. So the other piece of this, Matt, is, you know, when you actually do decide you're going to do an investigation, and I, you know, we're kind of getting away from the ID theft thing, but one of the things that we have been encountering lately are SIU investigators doing their own medical record reviews. Now, in some cases, there are instances where the investigator is actually a trained CPC or CPMA, and they've gone through, they've taken the course, they've gotten certified, and they've done that. In other instances, they may have taken the course but not sat for the exam. And in other instances, they're not an auditor, but they play one on TV. And, you know, there's what they call confirmation bias. And I talk about this a lot, and it's a very real thing. Confirmation bias essentially means that you have a predisposed set of feelings or thoughts about something, right? Your bias is something, and you set up a system or a practice or a test or a model to confirm that, right? Confirmation bias. So you're setting up something, and you see this a lot in empirical studies that are done. And by the way, anybody who was following the Karen Reed trial out of Boston, confirmation bias was at the forefront as they talked about the injuries that were sustained by the individual who was, you know, hit by the car and died. And they talked about confirmation bias, that there was this belief that a certain set of facts lent themselves to the injuries. And some of the studies that were done by some of the vendors were based upon what they believed to be confirmation bias. And the theory being that as an investigator, you already have a set of ideas in your head because this person has, the cream has risen to the top. And now if you're going to do an audit of that review or investigational review of the medical records, you kind of have that. And so while that's going to be the case for someone who's on the audit side of your medical record review, because obviously they're working in the payment integrity function and they've already got that, we want to at least try to separate out as much of that confirmation bias as we can. And auditors are doing their job, which is to just provide an objective, analytical, based upon the policies and no other facts. They have policies, they have records, they do that audit. Confirmation bias comes in because as investigators, we want to get the bad guy. And as investigators, we know this. And the three of us having been at the OIG and doing our work, we're dogs with bones. And you invest a lot of time and effort and energy, and SIU investigators do the same thing. That's a real thing. And what we have really been talking about is that your payment integrity unit or your SIU team, you need to have people that have very defined roles within that unit.
Right. You know, the goal used to be the auditor, right? You could do both halves of it. But you're right. That is a problem in that subconsciously, unconsciously, you have the facts of that case in the back of your mind. You know, through statements made or whatever else type of information you've received, you know what's going on in that office with that provider. And that sticks with you when you're looking at the medical records. A coder should be looking at the code, the policies for that code, the regulations behind that code, and what's the language, the specific language in the medical record, and comparing A to B. This fits that, this supports that, this is there, this isn't there, and that's it. For someone that's got inside information about the provider, that, you know, enough that you opened a case against them, that's going to flavor whatever determinations you make. And that can come back to really haunt you on appeal, or in, if it gets to a court, it's a very tough road to hoe when you're on the witness stand and they say, oh, so you investigated this, you were the allegations, you decided this was a case worthy, and now you're doing this objective review.
Right. And you know, Matt, and we've talked about this a lot. if you're ever in a position where you have to testify in any shape or form, deposition, administrative law judge, criminal, civil, administrative trial, anything, you are going to be in a position where you're going to have to defend your actions always, even though your actions may have been entirely warranted. But we have all experienced situations where we have been in a position where even when we've done the right thing, you get a half an hour of being questioned about the right thing that you did. And I think, you know, I give the example all the time about, you know, I had 9 trials in my career, and one of them I spent an inordinate amount of time explaining why notes were written a week before or 2 weeks before the report was written. A half an hour or 45 minutes about that. And so it really comes down to, even though you're right, you could be wrong for being right. And, you know, just have to spend that extra time of hand wringing for something. And so there are going to be things that you're going to have to explain no matter what. But it always comes down to, if you can limit, you know, if my interview report, and again, the story was my partner who took the notes was going on vacation. It was a post-arrest interview. The assistant U.S. attorney wanted that interview report quickly because it was a part of a much larger kickback case. My partner on the case was going on vacation, and I said, well, just give me the notes and I'll write it up. And, you know, there was nothing nefarious about it. Had those notes been written up the day after the interview, while I might have still been on the stand for 3 or 4 hours, it would have been 3 or 4 hours of other shenanigans. It wouldn't have been 45 minutes of that shenanigans. And so you really want to be able to limit, right, some of that exposure that you might, you know, already be getting hit with.
Yeah. The defense's job is to raise doubt. Why bring doubt into the process by doing something that they're going to jump? They see it as an opportunity to poke a hole in the facts.
Right.
And so doing your own reviews. No.
And I think to some extent, you know, the way that I would couch it is, if you've got somebody in that role, maybe it's a junior role and they're doing the lead vetting, right? So a complaint comes in, they request 2 or 3 medical records, they do the review and they say, yeah, this is nothing or this is something, and then pass it on to someone else, where that skill set is used in the preliminary function to educate and train and develop maybe someone who's an auditor who wants to become an investigator, you know, someone who is interested in becoming an auditor, right? Because they're doing the audits from the investigative side or the investigation from the audit side, where they're melding those two roles. But you're giving them that ability. If someone really wants to be an investigator and they're really now an auditor, this is a great way to bring someone in kind of in an entry-level position where they could be mentored, educated, and trained to learn the ins and outs of doing a healthcare fraud, waste, abuse investigation and get trained where their findings are used to move the case forward. Their findings are not being used as the final, you know, rubber stamp of indicia of FWA or compliance violations.
And we're starting to do that here. We're hiring CPCs to start as investigators and vice versa. So,
and I know from what I'm hearing, it's working out really well because we're bringing in people who have, for example, I know we have a nurse here that is now an investigator, has a great clinical and documentation background, and she's going to be amazing because she is looking at things, learning the ropes, vetting the cases and making these determinations about what is and what isn't something that time should be spent on. So the Wades of the world aren't spinning their wheels on 10 identity theft cases that wind up going nowhere. So it's an important thing to think about. It really does work towards ROI. It really does work towards morale. You know, working on a bunch of cases, you know, we used to always call us the barking dogs, right? You're working on a bunch of dogs, you're getting nowhere. And this is a way to increase ROI. It's a way to increase viability. It's a way to streamline the noise because you have to streamline the noise. So important topic. And, you know, it's sometimes these nuances that you find when we meet with some of our SIU clients and our payer clients on some of their patterns and practices, which maybe 10 years ago worked well, but today may not work well. And so you have to be, in a position to be adaptable to some of the changing landscape that's out there. So for those of you out there, you know, let us know, are you doing these cases? And if you are working identity theft cases, are you successful? We're not going to put a LinkedIn Live poll up, but if you think that you've got something, sure, you know, share it when you see it here on LinkedIn Live, and drop us a note or a message and let us know if it's working for you. And if you are using auditors separately from investigators, let us know what you think about that as a practice too. We find it successful. We're instilling that into some of our plans, and it's working really well. Investigators investigate, auditors auditate. They support the investigations, and they do the pieces of the puzzle that they're good at doing. So great topic. Always good seeing you guys. For those that went to NAMPI, I know that some of you got to run into Jean Marie and Dan Olson while you were there. Hope you enjoyed spending your time seeing them and sharing some stories and talking about all things Medicaid payment integrity. We've got some great stuff coming up. I think today we just posted, Dan Olson and I will be doing part two of data. We're going to be talking about a bunch of things, the least of which is going to be the life cycle of a claim. I think it's very important for investigators to understand when they're looking at a claim and you're looking at that long string of numbers in what's known as the DCN, the document control number, or the document identifier. Like, what does that all mean? And why is that important for investigators to know? And also data modeling. So Wade, Matt, and I just touched upon data modeling a little bit when it comes to outdated or old codes or plan related policies. We're going to talk a little bit about that. So join us for that. I think it's going to be September 30th. We're doing that. So the end of September, you got a little bit of time to plan that on your calendar. And as always, we appreciate everybody providing us with the feedback. We look forward to engaging with you on future LinkedIn Lives, on our weekly podcast. And for those of you that are going to NAMPI this or NHCAA this fall, we look forward to seeing some of you at the NHCAA as well this fall. So until next time, we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.